Thanks for joining us on today's edition of the Portland Christian Center podcast. This week, Pastor Joel Slater continues our series, Making Life Work, with a message titled, The Cure for Comparison. Now here's Pastor Joel.
I'm going to rewrite that. April showers bring May hours, hours and hours and hours of activity at Portland Christian Center. And you have no idea how many, somebody's excited about that. Thank you for the acknowledgement. Yeah. This church doesn't stop. It is going night and day. All right, I got guys up in the booth and everything. They were here until 8 o'clock last night on a Saturday. Everything. I mean, they're just going like crazy. We have things going on, not only locally, not only inside our church, as you saw and what you're going to see here tonight, but we have things going locally. Our Compassion Connect happened up here at Wilson High School yesterday. It was absolutely amazing, yeah. We have stuff going on internationally. Yes, we are an international church and everything. My name is Pastor Joel Slater. I'm the senior associate. I don't usually preach here. Pastor Ray and Linda are our lead pastors, and they have gone international. All right, so they're up in Canada today. Yeah. No, they haven't left. They're just gone. They're just for the weekend, you know. And they are up in Canada with our Petros Canada team raising money to plant churches in Ethiopia and around the world. And so they're having a phenomenal time. So Portland Christian Center does not stop. It doesn't stop. And if that wasn't enough, okay, we got stuff happening here. We got stuff happening up there. We have stuff happening way up north in Canada and everything. And now we're going to get ready to send another team to Central America with the Little Davy Project. And so Little Davy Project, you're getting ready to go to Central America to build computers for Latin American childcare schools. So if you're involved in that program and you're leaving here soon, will you please stand up? Are you here? Fantastic. See? So be praying for this team because, like I said, Portland Christian Center does not stop proclaiming the gospel around the world. So let's be praying for these teams as they leave. I want to give you a report. They say numbers don't lie. And so I want to give you some specific numbers. Pastor Ron gave a few about our Compassion Connect. This is an incredible organization and outreach to the people who need practical services, medical and dental services in our community. But more so, they need to know that people care about them. The compassion of Jesus moves us to action. And I'm going to give you some numbers that show just how much the compassion of Jesus has moved people in our community, in our congregation, and in our city today. So yesterday, I believe that people were on site up at Wilson High School at 5 a.m. just yesterday alone. I know people were there all day on Friday unloading and setting up equipment. But yesterday between 5 a.m. and approximately 3 p.m., and that's just for the clinic itself, over 360 total volunteers were helping at the Compassion Clinic. Out of those 360 volunteers, 175 were from Portland Christian Center alone. All right. Now, the amazing miracle is that it doesn't just happen with us, but we partnered with at least four stakeholder churches. So four churches met regularly for months and months and months to pool their resources, to collaborate, to help one another. And then, like always happens, a couple of churches at the last minute jumped in and said, hey, can we help? And so six churches partnered together in unity to make an impact in our community. All right. So because of your giving, because of your efforts, 145 patients were seen in the dental clinic alone. 140 medical visits, including basic medical care, chiropractic care, vision care, foot care, all sorts of care. I was standing at the desk and they asked me if I needed medical and I said, only if you provide psychological. And they actually started filling out a form for me. So apparently they offered that as well. But we not only that, we saw the power of partnership extend beyond the boundaries of the actual high school because we saw three off-site dental offices open up their facilities to these patients. We were running shuttles back and forth, and these dental offices say, if you can't handle it in-house, in the gym, we'll handle it for you. And so we partnered with them. We saw 10 dental chairs running all the time at the clinic inside Wilson High School. We saw one mobile dental van that allowed some lab work to be done and some amalgams to be made and some materials to be processed. That was amazing. Casey Eye Institute up there on OHSU Hill brought their eye care van so people could get glasses and eye exams. And bottom line, there just were a lot and lot of smiles. And if you've ever had a toothache, if you've ever had a backache, if you've ever had a foot cramp, if you've ever had your glasses broken and where am I going to get the money to fit, you know the power of an act of compassion, don't you? And so we are so grateful to Tom Moore, the deacon who led this endeavor on behalf of Portland Christian Center. Tom, are you here today? And if you're not, I don't blame you one bit. You worked hard, my friend. And Pastor Lauren, who led worship, he was our pastoral representative. Mike Jensen, who led so diligently in security and so many areas, and the literally hundreds of volunteers that made it happen. Let us give a round of applause to the people who made the Compassion Connect happen. So like I said, Portland Christian Center is on the move, and if you missed your opportunity this year, never fear. There are always multiple opportunities, and we want you to be involved in them, not for just your sake, but for the sake of those who need you to come alongside with them. So thank you so much for giving of your time, your talent, of your treasures in that way. Well, let's look into God's Word today. As you remember, we have been in a series called Making Life Work and have looking for real-world solutions for everyday living. And as we looked at this idea of the Compassion Connect, I was thinking kind of in a medical kind of thought process, and I was just kind of comparing, you know, just the needs of the community and to what we can offer, and I just began to compare. I began to compare a lot of things, and at lots of examples in our life, we compare, don't we? Compare, you know, the quality of our healthcare to the quality of other nations, don't we? We compare the quality of our life to the quality of other people. I mean, you can't get around comparison. In fact, I got a phone call last night. Somebody called me, and I missed the call, and I called them back, and I said, oh, I wasn't trying to call you. I was using the voice activation on my phone, and I said, doggy daycare, and the phone said, calling Joel Slater. That hurts. That really hurts. That's where I score. You can't help but compare yourself, can you? And what I want to talk to you today is about something that I've actually kind of noticed in my own life, and I feel like it's something that our church may need to take a look at, if not for you, maybe for someone else today. But we're in a series in the book of Proverbs, and I believe Proverbs talks about this situation. And if you've been here for some time, you've heard that the book of Proverbs is to be understood as a proactive book. That the book of Proverbs was written as a proactive book designed to encourage readers to live in harmony with the general God-given order. It's a proactive book. We looked at it earlier on. It's actually written to young people and saying, if you will align your life with God's word, if you will align your life with God's given order, it will go well with you. Proverbs is a book that carries the call for each of us to come to a defining moment in our lives, whether before, now, hopefully not too long after. But it carries a call to decide between living God's way or living the world's ways. And I hope that if you're a young person, you're choosing to do that. You're in the right place. Pastor Aaron, Pastor Tom, our children's ministry are seeking to help you to align your world according to the God-given order. But what happens if we're too late? What happens if we didn't do that when we were young? And as we've gotten older, we've formed patterns and we developed habits. And we're sitting here at a moment in time and recognizing when we look at the book of Proverbs that, no, I have not done that. The question is it too late? Well, I'm here to tell you, no, it's not. It's never too late. But sometimes we are too late in some things, aren't we? You know, I think about all these people that came to the Compassion Connect Clinic. And I think about, you know, we can pass judgment and we can blame society, we can blame a lot of things. But, you know, how often is it true that maybe they didn't have access to the care, maybe they just didn't look for it hard enough, but how many of us, you know, bearing different circumstances, would find ourselves in the same situation where we had an ache in our jaw, or we had an ache in our back, or something didn't feel good, and we just put it off till later? That was just, it's like, you know what, I don't need to deal with it right now, I can put up with it, I can handle it, I'm sure it'll go away. And a little problem that could have been dealt with early on became a big problem later on, didn't it? You know, I watched as people went into the dental clinic, and I would say, you know what? Been there, done that. In fact, we have a dentist here in this church and everything, and I'm sure that my dental work has paid for at least one of his kids to go to college. It's true. Because no one, no offense to dentists, but no one likes to go into you. And they hope, and they avoid, and they put off because it's going to hurt or it's going to cost and everything. The problem is when they do come and see you, come on, Dennis, like, you know, you sit there and you look, if you had only come to me sooner, we could have dealt with this a lot easier and a lot cheaper. And so the problem is with some things in our lives, we don't deal with them too soon. We don't prevent the problem. We can't avoid the sickness, and we can't avoid the damage. And all of us, don't we? All of us know we're supposed to go to doctors. We're supposed to see our dentist regularly. We're supposed to check in with our health care providers, and we're supposed to seek preventative medicine. That's the buzzword of the day, isn't it? We go to discover those things, to treat the things, remove the things early in order to minimize the damage, don't we? And I know that I'm not real good about this. And recently, I was in a chapel, and one of our staff members shared a word that just hit me between the eyes. And it was something that I had been putting off for a long time. I knew it, I felt it, I sensed it, and I realized in that moment that, I'm there, that I haven't done a good job of getting on top of something. And I realized in that moment that I'm sick. I'm sick. And perhaps you have what I have. Perhaps you haven't seen the symptoms yet, but here today, God has shed his light on our lives to say maybe we're infected, that we're carriers of a sickness that's subtle, but it's chronic, and if left untreated, it can get pretty bad. And the sickness is called comparisonitis. It's the comparison sickness. Because we all compare, don't we? We all compare, not just health plans and insurance policies, but we compare ourselves to everyone else. We compare our friends to other friends. Well, I'm not going to go there because I don't have any friends, and they have all the friends. We compare our boyfriends and our girlfriends, don't we? You get a boyfriend, you get a friend, you want to show them off. And then you meet somebody else's boyfriend. They're taller, they're stronger, they're more athletic, they're more talented. He plays the guitar. I don't play the guitar. No offense, Pastor Tom. Try not to be jealous on that one. We compare our spouses. Why can't you cook like she can? Why can't you fix things like he can? We compare our siblings. I have a real hard time with this one. Meet my brother, the doctor. Yeah. You know, Jay's getting his doctorate. Yeah, I know. So happy for him. Just being real, folks. We compare our kids. We compare our careers. We compare our possessions to everyone else's. A writer named Jack Canfield said about this sickness, about its symptoms, and about its outcome. He said, I generally find that comparison is the fast track to unhappiness. I don't know why we do it. I don't know how I allowed myself to get infected with this. But at the end of the day, I find that this is true. Because isn't it true that we feel like less than those who have more? How often do we feel bad when others have it good? You know, they used to say ignorance was bliss, and I'm here to tell you I agree with that. Because until the advent of Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and you know and this, I had an idea of what you had, but now you're putting it in my face. I heard you went to Hawaii, but now you're showing me what I'm missing. You got a new house. Great. Oh. It's got hardwoods. I bought the earlier model. And that wasn't a given. That was an option. Oh, we compare, don't we? And maybe more disturbing, we feel better when others have it worse. Don't believe me? Let's try a little diagnostic. Pay attention to the conversations inside your head when you see others succeed in areas where you're struggling. How are you doing with that? See, we measure everyone. We measure ourselves by everyone else. You know, it's just kind of how am I doing? Am I as good as them? Am I capable as them? Am I as mature as them? I mean, maybe I'm not as mature as them, but I'm certainly not as immature as them. And we try to find a way to make ourselves feel better by looking to compare ourselves with everyone else. You can call it comparison. You can call it envy. But at the end of the day, regardless of what you call it, it's dangerous. And here's why. Because some of us have emotional issues because of comparison. We have driven ourselves into depression because of comparison. I don't have this. I can't do that. I don't know him. No one knows me and everything. I can't do this like they can and everything. So I'm going to withdraw and I'm going to sink into depression, isolation, alienation. And then I don't know why I'm so down all the time. Some of us have relational woes because of comparison. Some of us haven't talked to siblings, haven't talked to our parents, haven't talked to friends for a long, long time because you saw what they had, you saw what they did, and somehow you compared your worth to their worth, and now you can't talk to them because the pain is too great. You let it go, you let it slide, you let it lie underneath the surface, and it began to fester, and it's infected you that much. Some of us are facing financial debts because of comparison. Hey, the Joneses got this. Poor Joneses. I'm sorry for you guys. You get picked on all the time. The Joneses got this. The Joneses bought that. The Joneses went here. The Joneses go there. And you're trying to keep up. And what's wrong with me? I don't want to let anyone know that I can't afford to go out and I can't do this and I do that. And so we run up the credit card and we borrow from Peter and we steal from Paul so that we can keep up appearances all because that we're comparing ourselves to someone else. And then some of us have had career problems because of comparison. You've cut corners. You've fudged numbers. You told your boss you were on that when you weren't. All because you didn't want to look weak and incompetent and struggling. And then the review came. And then the evaluation came. And then the client called. And you realize that you've got a problem and it's all because of comparison. August Turok, a writer, said, "Instant gratification lures us into taking ethical shortcuts that can ruin a business, a reputation, or even a life." It's true. It all comes from comparison. The Bible warns us about it thousands of years ago. Again, Proverbs, a book that's trying to set you up for success from the beginning. And I want to talk for just a moment to the young people and everything. Is you are so capable and you are so able, but you are also so vulnerable because you have the world at your fingertips through your phones, your tablets, and there's no filter. And you're getting a message saying, this is what you need. This is what you have. If you don't have it, then you're worthless. And I'm here to say that Jesus Christ made that definition and defined your value 2,000 years ago on a cross, and anything Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter says is an absolute lie from the pit of hell. You will never find what you need on a screen or from someone else who tells you that because if you don't have something, you're worth nothing. The Bible warned us about it. And again, Proverbs is a book that tells you how to set up your life for beforehand. So whether you're young or old, if you're young at heart, I'm going to challenge you to look at God's word today. We're going to move through several scriptures here today. Proverbs 14:30 says this, "A heart at peace gives life to the body." Sounds good. "But envy rots the bones." Envy rots the bones. Job 5:2 says, "Resentment kills a fool. And envy slays the simple." James 3:16 says, "For where you have envy and selfish ambition, there you find disorder and every evil practice." Folks, it's not a far cry. Some of you are locked in pornography because of comparison. That your spouse is not as physically attractive as that fake airbrush doctored picture on the screen. You hate your job because of what someone says about their job on Facebook. And the saying is true. Oh, I wish your life was as good as you say it is on Facebook. There's more to the story. There's more to the story. Proverbs tells us through compressed experiences, and you may be looking for the exceptions to the rule, and I tell you there are exceptions to every rule. But the reality is that Proverbs looked at life through a compressed experience and tells us about a possible world where behavior results in generally predictable consequences. And if you let envy dwell too long, maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but that infection will continue and it will run systematically through your life till that's all you can see and you can't see what you've already got. Proverbs 15:16 says this, better a little with the fear of the Lord than great wealth with turmoil. Now, I know some of you are thinking, yeah, I'd like to test that one. I'd like to try that out just for a little while. But tell you, through compressed experiences, it's true. Proverbs 16:8 says, better a little with righteousness than much gain with injustice. Proverbs 28:6 says, better the poor whose walk is blameless than the rich whose ways are perverse. Now you may be saying, yeah, I know that. I know that. We talked about that in another message. But as we said before, biblical wisdom is not theoretical knowledge. Again, so many people here in this room, you have access, you have a grasp on so much more knowledge than the generations before you. It's not that you don't know this, but biblical wisdom is not knowing. Biblical wisdom is not theoretical knowledge. Biblical wisdom is applied knowledge. It's actually even more than that. You know, you want to talk about the comparison sickness. My pastor gets up here last week and he blows it out of the water with this sermon no one's ever heard about the Proverbs 31 woman. And I get up here and I'm like, oh man, I gotta do at least as good as that. And he pulls out this Hebrew word that I'm not even gonna try to pronounce about a woman of valor. So what do? I go find my own Hebrew word. Two can play this game. The Hebrew term for wisdom is chokmah. And it means, yeah, I wasn't going to try that word, I'm going to try my own. The Hebrew term for wisdom, chokmah, is skill. Biblical wisdom is not knowledge, it's skill. In biblical wisdom literature, wisdom is pictured as social, verbal, and administrative skill. And if you haven't had those, if you didn't set yourself with those skills early in life, never fear, because Proverbs isn't the only book that talks about this. Proverbs is another book of the Bible in the wisdom literature category is Ecclesiastes. And Ecclesiastes is also called wisdom literature. The difference between Proverbs and Ecclesiastes is that Proverbs hopes to get out ahead of people and show them the way to live from the beginning. But if you're not there, if you're not aware, and if you're looking back, I've got a lot of making up to do, then Ecclesiastes is a book for you in that it talks about wisdom from hindsight. You know, if you're a young person, you're saying, that's not going to happen to me, then let's move over to the other side of the spectrum and say from someone who lived it, dwelt in it, experienced it, say, oh, contraire. Hindsight is 20/20, isn't it? I mean, come on, every single one of us knows things now you wish you knew then. I got one word for you. Apple. You wish you'd known that Apple II you played with in elementary school, you wish you knew the power of that company. Hindsight is 20/20, isn't it? And so Ecclesiastes looks from hindsight. And the speaker in Ecclesiastes, they call him the teacher. And I think he went to the school of hard knocks. But he shares with us that he can discover, that he, when he looks at this, he discovers meaning in nothing. There is no meaning in anything when he examines life only from the human perspective. And throughout the book of Ecclesiastes, he uses this term, under the sun, to mean in the material world, in the world that you're living in the world you're comparing, and the things that you want, and the things you got to have, and the things you got to go after and everything, under the sun, it's meaningless. See, the sad, sick truth about the deception of comparison is the reality of this, is that you will never look like that other person. If only I could look like him. If only I could look like her. I remember taking a picture of a haircut to someone who cut my hair, and it says, can you make me look like this? She goes, I'm good, but I'm no miracle worker. Imagine how crushed I was. You may never look like that other person. You may never own what that other person owns. Your spouse may never be, may never look like, act like, attain what another spouse may. Your kids may never achieve what other kids achieve. But the teacher in Ecclesiastes sits down and he looks at all these patterns of human behavior, and then he simply decides this. whether it looks like it or not, whether it seems like it or not, whether it sounds like it or not, sin is always at the end of comparison. Whether it looks like it or not, sin is always going to be at the end of comparison. And the funny thing about sin is that it doesn't seem like a bad thing at first, and so I'll let it lie. I'll just settle. I'll just kind of ignore it and hope it goes away. But the thing about sin, it is chronic, and it increases, and it's systematic, and it moves through your system till it degrades you to the very core. Ecclesiastes drives home the curse and the consequence of comparison. Sin skewers even our best attempts at looking at our situations and circumstances objectively. Wisdom, applied knowledge, skillful application of God's word knows that at the end of the day, if I continue in ignoring my comparisonitis, that it will end up in sin. Sin is always, always, always the end of comparison. And wisdom knows that the only cure for comparison is contentment. Contentment. In a few moments, I'm going to give you an opportunity to receive that cure here. But we got to diagnose what it really is. Contentment is this. Contentment is somehow having peace on the inside, even when everything on the outside is going crazy or seemingly unequal. You know, that's a big, big topic in today's society, inequality. The haves and the have-nots. And it's a reality. And it's not something to settle for. I'm not here today to say just settle for it, be satisfied, though that's the way it always is. No, there's a real need. That's why we do things like the Compassion Clinic. It's not a matter, oh, they should just get health care. Oh, they should just find a doctor. Oh, they should just eat better. No, when there's a need, we see it and we feel it, don't we? Because we're moved with compassion. But at the end of the day, there is something insidious about stoking those fires of comparison that always leads to sin and denies that it's possible to find contentment on the inside, even when on the outside everything is unequal. Contentment is the ability to be settled internally, even when you're struggling externally. It's not the absence of struggle, but it's the fortification inside that you can withstand it. In other words, contentment is not a static state of being. It's not just something you just receive. It's not something that just pings. I wish you could just get an automatic upgrade to contentment. I just wish you could set the operating system of your brain at midnight every Sunday. I upload contentment 2.1.3. And I wake up not worrying about what someone else has or someone else does. It's not an inherent trait for one personality. You type A's out there going, this is killing me. Because it doesn't exist. It's not the matter of an inherent trait, but it is chokmah. It is a learned skill that we can attain to build a God-honoring life. Folks, we need to recognize that sin skewers even our best attempts at looking at our situations and circumstances objectively. I mean, look what happens when you try to find contentment. It's fine to find a contentment, but we go so far and out in so many different ways of finding it, don't we? We look for contentment through the benefit of our career. Look with me in Ecclesiastes. We're going to walk through several verses in Ecclesiastes. And I hope you get a taste for this book. But the teacher says, when you look for contentment in the benefit of your career, men, this is where you and I struggle. And a lot of ladies, you struggle with this too. Because we find our identity in our career, don't we? Patrick Morley in his book, Man in the Mirror, says, if a man is unhappy in his job, he's unhappy. That may explain some things right there. But then you better drill down to why. But if you find benefit in your career, Ecclesiastes 2:11 says, yet when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless. It was a chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun. I worked my hands to the bone and I built a career. I built an empire. And at the end of the day, it was worthless. What if we find content through wealth? If I can just have money, how many people without raising their hands would say, my number one goal in life is to be a millionaire? And believe me, there are some days where I want to give this all up and just go be a handsome billionaire. Be a lot easier. But if we go to that, we think that, we pursue that. And Ecclesiastes 6:2 says, God gives some people wealth, possessions, and honor. Good. So that they lack nothing their hearts desire. But get this, look at this. But God does not grant them the ability to enjoy them, and strangers enjoy them instead. It's interesting that God does not give a double portion, the ability to attain wealth and the ability to enjoy it. They're two separate issues. If we try to find contentment in prestige, come on, we all do this no matter who we are and what our personality is. We try to find the prestige in the size of our homes. You get a house with 10-foot ceilings. So happy. But then you get invited to her house. She has 12-foot ceilings. And now you hate your house. Oh, again, you got hardwoods. Standard. Mine was an upgrade. I hate my house. Maybe you find prestige in your career or that of your spouse. You own a business. That's awesome. He owns franchises. Oh. What about the prestige in our kids' accomplishments? Oh, come on. Your kids read Dr. Seuss at 3. Their kids are reading biographies of Dr. Seuss at 3. So nice. Or we find prestige in the type of car, boat, toys, clothes, you name it. And Ecclesiastes 4:16 says, there was no end to all the people who were before them. There's always going to be someone who has more. But he says, but those who came later were not pleased with the successor. They weren't happy with what they got. And this too is meaningless. It's a chasing after the wind. Well, what about the good life? You know, I'm not looking for riches. I'm not selfish. I'm just looking for the good life. Chapter 6, verse 12 says, for who knows what is good for a person in life during the few and meaningless days they pass through like a shadow? Who can tell them what will happen under the sun after they're gone? See, the comparison sickness affects our brain. And you can sit down with someone, you could try to explain to them that, you know what, the good life isn't all that good in many ways. But they won't hear you because the comparison sickness left too long affects the brain, doesn't it? And even if we try to find attainment in some of the less tangible things of life, wisdom. How about wisdom? What's wrong with wisdom? You're talking about wisdom. But it says in chapter 2, verse 15, it says, then I said to myself, the fate of the fool will overtake me also. What then do I gain by being wise? I said to myself, this too is meaningless. See, the common thread of Ecclesiastes is that life lived with a view only of this world is meaningless. Solomon saw people. He did surveys. He did studies. At the end of his life, smart guy, looked at people determining where they were based on where everyone else was. And he reveals this, chapter 4, verse 4. He says, I saw that all toil and all achievement, all of it, spring from one person's envy of another. This too is meaningless. It's a chasing after the wind. Wow. Solomon said, you know what? It's meaningless. There's never going to be a finish line. There's never going to be a sense of satisfaction. There's never going to be that sense of tranquility, that peace, when we compare ourselves with other people. And so understand that the secret to begin being cured of comparison is to recognize that no matter whether it looks like it or not, sin is always at the end of comparison. Now, am I saying we don't try to work hard? Am I saying don't better yourself, don't get an education, don't strive, don't have goals, don't go out? No, I'm not saying that at all. In fact, Scripture doesn't even say that. Ecclesiastes 4:5 says, fools fold their hands and ruin themselves. So don't go out of here today and saying that I gave you a license to be lazy. Because that right there will lead you to a door of envy and comparison as well. Well, how come he got what I don't have? Because he did what you weren't willing to do. And so here's Solomon's way of fleshing out the solution. Chapter 4, verse 6. It says, better one handful with tranquility than two handfuls with toil and chasing after the wind. See, if you look to your left or you look to your right and you're not careful, you will begin chasing and never give up chasing everything, and you'll never feel okay. And nothing you get or achieve will satisfy. You'll get this and you'll get this, but then suddenly you'll look at him, oh, you have that. Ooh, I wish I didn't have this because now I want that. But there is a solution, and it comes from changing our perspective from one of this world to the eternal world. And that's where we find meaning and joy. Now, it's interesting that the New Testament never quotes Ecclesiastes. It quotes Proverbs, quotes some other wisdom books, but it never quotes Ecclesiastes. But the concept of foolish comparison versus the power of contentment is evident. And Paul recognized any message limited to hope under the sun as futile. In 1 Corinthians 15:19, he spoke to a congregation very much like American congregation, very wealthy, very wise in their own ways, very capable, very technologically savvy, very prominent, chasing the wind. And he said of this, "If only for this life we have hope in Christ, we are to be pitied more than all men." Let me just tell you something, folks. In this city, in this state, in this society, we have it pretty good. And we've probably led, intentionally or not, to give the impression that, hey, you got a good life, just add Jesus to it, and it'll get all better. I'm here to tell you today, that don't work. Jesus isn't an upgrade to your life. Jesus isn't meant to take a good life and make it better. Jesus wasn't here simply to say, oh, you got everything else, just add Jesus, and then you're good to go. Jesus is not the Sunday school God. Jesus is not the God that we give to children. He is the Alpha and the Omega. He is the beginning and the end. He is the firstborn of all creation. In him we have our salvation, and in him by all things were made. I'm here to tell you today, if you think that adding Jesus to your great life is going to make a great life better, you're missing it. Paul says it's futile. It's just chasing the wind. More than anything else, more than anyone else, Paul knew that through his life's experience that the worst thing we could do is abandon godly biblical wisdom in favor of comparing ourselves, because that will only complicate our circumstances. And so what's Paul's solution? He said this in a very familiar scripture you've all read before in Philippians 4. He says, "Teach me what it means to be content in the midst of my circumstances. Regardless of looking to the left and to the right, what do I got? What do I have? What am I doing right now? Teach me to be content in those." The healthy heart, the opposite of an envious heart, the opposite of a heart infected by comparisonitis, is in the Proverbs, and it's described as the ability to make good decisions in the use of what we have. And those decisions then become a source of life to our physical, emotional, spiritual, relational body. Philippians 4, 12 and 13. That's a passage you know, you're familiar, probably quoted. And Paul is writing this. And again, for some of you may take wisdom and say, you know, it's kind of hard to swallow, especially, you know those people. They've got a great life. They've got investments. They've got all these things. And they'll sit down with you and say, you know what? At the end of the day, it's not all it's cracked up to be. And you're sitting there going, yeah, right. Aren't you? When Paul talks about learning to be content, he's not in a position up high on a hill looking down on you, but he's down in a hole, chained to a guard. And he's saying, believe me, I know what it's like to feel like somebody else has more than you. I've been beaten. I've been persecuted. I've been trashed. I've been isolated. I've been alienated. What's my reward? I've served God, and this is all I get. Somebody else is out there living the good life, maybe preaching the gospel and making money from it. But Paul is sitting there, I'm chained to a guard, I have no freedom, and yet I can write this, Philippians 4, 12 and 13. I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. I mean, how can he say that? How can he say that? Second half of verse 12 says, I have learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. Did you catch that word? Did you catch the word in that? I have learned. You know that Greek word, learned? Again, it's not theoretical knowledge. That Greek word is actually a word used in the cults of the day, the secret mystery cults. And they use that word, learned, to describe initiation into a secret society. It means I have learned to be content. I have been initiated into the mystery of being content. Paul's saying that through times of both plenty and times of empty, somehow, by the power of God, by focusing on Jesus, by depending on Jesus, by walking with Jesus, by getting to know Jesus, somehow Jesus, it didn't happen in a moment. It didn't happen with a ping. Your phone didn't light up and alert you to say you've just been upgraded to contentment 2.3. But he found, by focusing on Jesus, by valuing Jesus, by making Jesus the center of his life, somehow he was initiated into a condition of contentment. And in spite of my personality, in spite of his circumstances, he learned to be content. I have had more than I needed, he said, but I didn't get addicted to what I had. So that when I lost it, so when I was in need, that was not the basis of my happiness. I have learned the secret to being content. I came across a quote earlier this week that really challenged me about where I find my contentment. Because the secret to contentment is Jesus. And the quote said this: when we pursue Jesus, the first mess we're going to run into is our own. When you pursue Jesus, the first mess you're going to run into is your own. And you know what? Jesus wants to deal with the comparison sickness in our lives. Because when we're looking to our left and we're looking to our right, we can't be looking at Jesus. You can't do it both ways. So as we get ready to close today, I want to give us a quick diagnostic. If you went to your doctor, if you went to your dentist, you wouldn't just sit in a room for 40 minutes and listen to the expert, nod your head in assent, and then walk out convinced that you're healed, would you? He'd have to do some diagnostics, wouldn't he? So go with me through some of these diagnostics. Ask yourself these questions. Are you exhausted from trying to keep up with blank? Are you exhausted with trying to keep up with you fill in the blank? I mean, you say to yourself, I wish I didn't know they had this. I wish I knew they didn't go there. I just wish I didn't know, because it's exhausting. Number two, are you broke from trying to keep up with? I mean, again, you've let it go so far that now you're in a hole you can't get out of. Oh, I wish I had known beforehand. Are you allowing what others have to keep you from enjoying what you do have? Man, they had this, they had that, they had this and the other and everything, and you don't even see what you have. How about this one? Are you allowing what you don't have to keep you from enjoying what you do have? Are you allowing what you don't have to keep you from enjoying what you do have? How about this one? I think this one is a big deal for especially families of our generation. Do you enjoy your children, or are you driving them crazy because of what everyone else's children are accomplishing? Are you pushing your kids so hard because that kid down the street or in that class or in your family even got a grade or got those SAT scores, or because their three-year-old is reading at an eighth grade level? And my kid's got to measure up. And this is why, honestly, this is the ramifications of leaving comparisonitis untreated. This is why some of you are disconnected from your family of origin, because your whole experience growing up was based on performance. Your parents compared you to somebody else's kid. Or how about the question, is it possible that your husband or your wife feels disconnected from you because you constantly compare them to somebody else's? Oh, you live in the same house, you sleep in the same bed, you share the same bank account, but you are seeing the disconnect because you're living mentally with someone else, maybe part-time. And then finally, and this is the hardest one for me to swallow, this is where my sickness really comes out. Who would you secretly enjoy seeing fail? You don't mind them having a good time, doing good things, but as long as they don't do it too much. How are you doing with that? I'm going to invite Pastor Lauren to come back to the piano. This series, Making Life Work, real solutions for everyday living. So you can know all the Bible knowledge, and you can have all the churchy words and everything, but when you're sick, life just doesn't work, does it? When you're sick, things don't move as good, don't feel as good, don't function as good, you're not at the right energy level. And folks, I think it's not flashy, it's not politically exciting, but I think this is one of the things that ails the church today. Satan doesn't have to do something huge, persecuting, take away our rights to keep the church from doing what the church needs to do. He simply has to keep the church from being united. See, Proverbs says, where there's unity, God commands his blessing. Look what happens when churches are united. Six churches, just in this neighborhood, get together and they make a difference in almost 150 people's lives. Well, they're the rich church. They should do it. Well, we do all the things anyway. They need to get on the ball and start doing some things. Isn't it amazing what can happen when no one cares who gets the credit? Isn't it exhausting when you're looking to your left and your right? You aren't making much progress. If you sat down across from someone and all they did was talk about someone else, about what they're doing, what they're not doing, everything, and wouldn't you look at them objectively as an objective outsider and say, well, what are you doing? Because you're wasting a whole lot of energy talking about them, and you're not getting anything done. Philippians 4:13 says this, I can do all this through him who gives me strength. Folks, this isn't about mentally nodding, walking out of here and saying, yeah, that sounds good, that sounds right, because you can't do it on your own. You can't cure yourself of the comparison sickness on your own. Ecclesiastes, again, that verse, says, better one handful with tranquility than two handfuls with toil and chasing after the wind. See, when I read that, I see this. If I've got two handfuls on everything I can attain in this life, when Jesus reaches out his hand and says, take my hand and I'll lead you into contentment, your hands are full. And you got to make a choice to let go of one thing in order to take the hand of the one that can lead you into everything.
Thanks again for listening to this week's edition of the Portland Christian Center podcast. If you want more information about the ministries of Portland Christian Center or have a prayer need, please visit us online at pcctoday.com. Thanks for listening.